Welcome, dear listener, to Swinging Through Spider-Man. We have actually ended up calling it that. We've just cut some letters out to make it work. This is a limited series podcast where we take a closer look at all the big screen adaptations of our favourite wall crawler, the uncanny, the invincible, the indomitable Spider-Man. I'm Tom Percival, an editor and journalist for Unilad, BBC film critic, and a lifelong Spider-Man fan. Joining me on this journey through the Spider-Verse, as always, is my co-host, the tentacles to my portly back, the esteemed Cameron Froome. Hello, Cameron.
Hello, Tom. that's probably your best
yeah,
yet.
Yeah, I was quite happy with that one.
Yeah, quite good.
In this episode, we're going to be talking about Spider-Man 2, and I'm going to do a quick recap. 2 years on from the first Spider-Man film, Peter is struggling to balance the responsibilities of being Spider-Man with his personal life. Things get even harder for our beloved wall crawler when a freak accident turns Dr. Octavius into the potentical Dr. Octopus. And to make matters worse, even his powers have started to fail him. Cameron, I'm going to start with the big question. Did Spider-Man 2 hold up for you?
Spider-Man 2 will always hold up for me and for everyone else, and anyone else who says otherwise is wrong.
I agree. I think I've rewatched it twice over the lockdown, and yeah, I controversially, I think I might have said in the introductory episode that I think Far From Home is the best Spider-Man film. It is Spider-Man 2, isn't it? Let's be completely honest. It just...
I mean, Far From Home is an absolutely tremendous movie. I think Spider-Man 2 is still my favourite.
Yeah, okay. I think, yes. You know what? In fact, I'm going to split the difference. I'm going to say Far From Home is my favourite. This is the best. Mm-hmm. And I have a thesis for why this is the best episode. And
okay.
We'll see whether you agree or not. I don't think any other Spider-Man film best grapples with that core idea of responsibility and self and choice like Spider-Man 2. I think they all aspire to it, especially Spider-Man 3, but they all drop the ball on the way, because this film ultimately is a film about choice and responsibility.
Yeah, that's one of the things I found particularly striking when I was watching it as an adult, and from the perspective of looking back and seeing how it holds up. The idea of Spider-Man, and even superheroes in general, battling everyday responsibility is something I think makes Spider-Man an already incredibly relatable character to millions of youth and retrospective adults, I suppose, makes him relatable in a way that we can actually grasp to. So when Batman breaks a batarang, or he's in the Batcave toiling with his gadgets and stuff like that because he's been injured the night before, we can go, oh, fuck, what a problem. like shit, this again, yeah. This bloody batarang. But when Peter Parker is late and turning in a uni assignment, or he is late, as is the recurring theme of the movie, he's late to everything, he is late to a show, or late to delivering pizzas on time, everyone can attach themselves to the idea in that scenario of just life getting away from them. And that is such a core theme of Spider-Man, which really ties nicely into the with great power comes great responsibility idea that's keeps Spider-Man stitched together.
His web slung together, almost.
Yes.
I'm proud of that one. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think no other film has captured that magic of sort of how shit Peter's life is quite like Spider-Man 2. I mean, you know, it's a joke in the film, Dictovich, the landlord. It would be horrifying in real life that you couldn't afford to pay $20 to keep a shit roof above your head.
That flat is horrible also. It's literally, it looks like a boiler room with a bed and he doesn't have his own bathroom, and then that bloody landlord comes over and just barges in the bathroom in the morning.
Is it weird that I don't like the landlady's daughter either?
Yes. Why would you not like her? She is she is literally the purest soul in the whole of Spider-Man.
You know my feelings, Cameron, on people who are nice.
she is a vessel for kindness. She makes him cake and brings him milk.
And that cake does look delicious.
It does look
delicious.
So
like last time, we're going to touch on four major points, which I've briefed you on. Spider-Man, and more importantly, the evolution of Spider-Man, how he's changed in this film. Doc Ock and the extended cast. And again, some more general thoughts about Sam Raimi as a filmmaker. So let's start with Spider-Man. We spoke in the first one about how awkward Tobey Maguire's Peter Parker is. It's even worse in this film.
It's so much worse.
I've completely forgotten that scene when he swings out, you know, when he rescues the kids from the truck, because Peter Parker lives in a cursed New York where bad things are happening every other second.
Nightmarish vignettes across the city.
We'll get to it later, but Christ alive, can that man walk through the city at night without spotting a fire? Anyway.
Well, that's the theory that drove Green Goblin's burning building plan in the previous movie.
Anyway, it's when he says to the kids, something like that. Watch out for traffic or something like that, and then he swings off and he ends up in a lift with a bloke later on, and it's like, did you make this? Oh, nice Spidey suit, did you make it yourself? Yeah, rides up in the crotch a little, and I was just like, oh, there's nothing.
What is happening in this scene?
There's nothing glamorous about being Peter Parker, is there?
No, there's literally nothing glamorous about it, but I suppose that that is the point for the predominant section of the movie, that Peter Parker has a hard done life. He still hasn't got the girl he wants. He is now warring with his best friend over his vengeance seeking over the bug for killing Green Goblin in the previous movie. He loses his job in the first 10 minutes.
What I labelled in my notes as the saddest birthday in the history of cinema. He loses his job. He is late to hand in a uni assignment, or misses a lecture or something. Is told that he's failing university. The one thing that he manages to do is earn $300, tarnishing his own reputation by selling a photo to J. Jonah Jameson. That's then immediately taken off him by Betty Brant. He then goes to his aunt's house, where the two people who he least wants to see, Mary Jane because he loves her, and there's this unrequited love bubbling under the surface, and Harry Osborn, who at this point has turned into a vengeful lunatic, and he has the saddest birthday party in the history of cinematic birthdays.
Just a little side note on Peter Parker trying to sell different pictures. Well, he has to sell the pictures of Spider-Man for $300. Yep. He tries to propose that the Daily Bugle put in the front page photos of an old man playing checkers and someone at the beach and the pigeons and the seagulls. And as two people who work in the social sphere of news reporting, it's blatantly obvious that that was never ever going to make the front page of a New York City daily institution of a newspaper.
No, when J. Jonah Jameson describes it as his National Geographic crap, I was just sat there like, very spot on, what is the story here? Man plays checkers.
Different side of Gotham for a change, as Peter pleads for him to use. Yeah, I would agree. It is literally, it's an awful, awful, awful birthday. Made only sweeter-ish by Aunt May giving him $20, which she quickly ruined by reminding him of her dead husband and his dead uncle.
And the fact that the family home is literally being taken from under them because Peter cannot provide for his Aunt May.
Sounds like the most depressing movie ever when you're talking about it on paper.
It is, but you know, let's put something that I'm keen to get to: the loss of his powers. Like, I don't really know how we should handle this part, because we spoke about how dreadful Peter's life is, and again, it touches on that key theme through this film. Peter has chosen this. He chose not to reveal his identity to MJ. He could have had her. He could have dated her. He could have prevented Uncle Ben from dying. He could have told Harry the truth about the Green Goblin, and he didn't do any of that. And now he's in this situation. And key theme running through this film, that idea of you have to own what you're doing. And that leads us quite neatly then into the idea of why of P- Peter, who throughout the film is slowly losing his powers. When you first saw it, why did you think they were fading?
Honestly, I think as a child watching it, I probably wouldn't have thought any further than him just losing his mojo. It's Austin Powers. Is that sounds? But yeah, back then I was just thought he's having a bit of a tough time and he's losing his powers, which I suppose is really what's happening. But the real nuance of the situation and the fact that his life is spiraling out of control, therefore, like you said, the aspect of choice is spiraling out of control. He's no longer choosing deep down that this is where he wants to be, and therefore he's losing the gift rather than privileges, as Otto Octavius says at one point in the movie. I think that's really interesting to do that for Spider-Man of all people. That I feel that's a bit more of a maturer conflict that you've seen for like Batman or I suppose even Superman.
Yeah, I agree. I think that like I remember when I first watched the film, I was kind of like yourself, just I didn't really know why he was, and I was waiting for that textual reason for why his powers come and go. So yeah, through the film, and then why they eventually do return in that triumphant scene in the cafe. But I did have like watching it this time, I've never really twigged, and I think it's because when I was a kid, I'd never really dealt with anxiety in the way that I've dealt with anxiety now. It was so clear to me now that it is entirely stress-based. Like, it's literally a lack of self-confidence. And as you said then, that self-doubt about whether he's made the right choice, whether he should be Spider-Man, whether he wants to be Spider-Man, that's why they're going. It's nothing to do with, comic sci-fi stuff like, yeah, you know, Norman Osborn's poisoned him with some gas that's taking away his powers or anything like that. It's so much more human than that. And that, again, is why this film works quite so well for me.
Yeah, every single one of us, or at least many of us, especially people who have kind of hectic working lives, as I certainly vouch for Tom when I say we both have fairly hectic working lives. Everyone has battled the problem of wanting to do absolutely everything, and constantly putting something in priority over the others. But also still trying to do everything. And for Peter, that is wanting to go see MJ's show badly more than anything, I'm sure. I don't think he does view it as something that he feels he just has to do. He deeply wants to be there. However, when he sees people in trouble, he feels compelled by the nature of his powers to go and help. And that is constantly inhibiting all of his daily life. And he's struggling to learn how to prioritise his responsibilities. With great power comes great responsibility, as Uncle Ben said. So yeah, that whole theme ties together particularly nicely in Spider-Man 2, and like you said, I think that is why it makes this movie very effective over most of the Spider-Man
oeuvre. I'd go further. I'd say it's what elevates it to one of the best superhero films ever made. It's because it's saying something about, again, we are just repeating the word responsibility here, but it's just something everyone can relate to. That anxiety of, am I doing enough? Like, have I made the right choices? I think that it was relevant in 2000 and it's even more relevant in 2020. That hyper stress of, what am I doing with my life? Am I making the right choices? It's interesting you mentioned, you know, like he wants to go see MJ's show and he wants to do this and he wants to do that, but Spider-Man keeps getting in the way, because I want to talk less about Peter for a bit and more about Spider-Man himself and the evolution of that side of things. Because in the first film, we only really get that one montage, as I call it. You know, we get the montage of him stopping crime, and then we get, basically, he's only fighting the Green Goblin from then on, both at the parade and then later on the bridge. I really like in this film that we see some of the lower key spider crimes. And when he's on his way to MJ's and we see the carjacking or the robbery, whatever it is, and the way he stops that car, I'd completely forgotten how good that scene is when the cop car flies out of control, it's about to hit the crowd, and all of a sudden it stops in midair, and the camera twists, and the webs catch the light, and a woman just goes, "It's Spider-Man!" And he swings overhead, and then they ruin it by going, "Go get him, Spidey!" But, you know, I...
Yeah, that also precedes the coolest Spider-Man related shot in any movie, which is Spider-Man flying through the gap in the lorry, crossing the New York yes. street. That is what plays through my head when I think of like Spider-Man swinging through New York City, that exact moment.
See, I also really like how when he lands on the convertible, thank God they're in a convertible, and he just webs them to a lamppost. Although, yeah. It does raise questions about how, because he then drives the car back to the theatre in his suit. That does raise a few questions about, did he stop and get the suit? Did he get changed in the car? Did he put the roof up to do it? What was he doing?
These questions will remain unanswered because Peter Parker as Spider-Man achieves great wonders.
We'll have Sam Raimi on to talk about it. But yeah, no, I do think that the Spider-Man in this film seems more self-assured. I spoke in the last one about how awkward he was, like how the banter didn't really land. And sure, the banter's not great in this one, but it does feel slightly more natural. In the bank scene, for example, when he throws the coins back at Doc Ock and "You forgot your change!" or something like that. I was like, that one's better than the last one.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the quips and stuff like that. This movie and Spider-Man's relationship with the villain, perhaps it doesn't really warrant the same quips. They don't have a dynamic which calls for tit-for-tat dialogue, because Spider-Man and Dr. Octopus, as much as they're enemies in this movie, it's not a personal vengeance. Spider-Man is just completely in the way. And that is something that I did mention in the last podcast, the fact that for Spider-Man's villains throughout the movies, Spider-Man is often just a figure that's in the way, desperately in the way, of their ultimate endgame, whereas Green Goblin's endgame was killing Spider-Man. And yeah, I think that it's evident in how Spider-Man and Dr. Octopus interact. And don't get me wrong, yeah, there is the "here's your change," and there's a couple other lines throughout it, but I would agree Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man is more fully formed as a physical, capable superhero compared to the first one, regardless of his verbosity.
I think the scenes we see, because we get the fantasy car sequence where Peter talks to Ghost Uncle Ben about, you know, like, "I don't want to do this, I'm Spider-Man no more." And we get when we see the montage of "Raindrops keep falling on my head."
Oh my God, the freeze frame, man. The freeze frame.
We will talk about the freeze frame, because what? But he feels a lot more natural and a lot more comfortable in the character's skin. And it was I couldn't help but think when I was watching it this time, and I know that in the third film, it is supposed to be a more cocky, arrogant, slightly deluded Peter. But this Peter...
That's one word for it.
But this Peter feels so much more comfortable in his own skin. Like, Tobey Maguire even feels more comfortable in Peter's skin. He feels more comfortable as Spider-Man. I just think all the elements are pulling in the right direction on this one.
I would totally agree with that. It's like you mentioned, I won't go too deeply into it. Like, Spider-Man 3 pulls in the threads in the wrong direction. Whereas Spider-Man 2 tests Peter while still making him seem earnest and relatable without taking him too far out the realms of reality. Considering his powers, that's quite a feat to accomplish.
And in fact, no, I won't answer that question yet. I'll ask that question later. But you mentioned Doc Ock before, so the villains sort of dominate these films. I think it's fair to say Alfred Molina is a different villain to the Green Goblin, but perhaps a superior one. Would you agree?
Yes and yes. Yes. Yes, I would. And that is in absolutely no way a huge criticism of Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin, because if you listen to the previous episode, you'll hear us praising him to the high heavens.
This podcast is pro-Green Goblin.
It's very pro-Green Goblin. He is impressive. But, however, Alfred Molina's Green Goblin is better, but that isn't the main point of my praise for him. He is formed in a very different way. His dynamic with Peter is even keener than his relationship with Spider-Man, because they both have a mutual respect, albeit Alfred Molina's Otto Octavius is much further in his field than Peter Parker is, obviously, as a student. However, they both love intelligence. They love they're both intelligence. Otto says the quote, intelligence is not a privilege, it's a gift, and you have to use it for the gift of for the benefit of mankind. That is, that theme runs concurrently with everything that's going on in the movie. It attaches to both Spider-Man and Otto Octavius, and his downfall and Spider-Man's rise, and the sketching of Otto Octavius and Alfred Molina's performance is spot on.
I mean, this is just going to turn into a love-in for Spider-Man 2, because I completely agree. One thing that I'll say is Otto Osborn works on two levels for me, because he represents, first of all, what Peter wishes he could have. He wants that life of, I'd say simple life, you know, when he's creating the power of the sun in the palm of my hand. You know, like, it's not a simple life, but it's a believable life, a life with the woman he loves, doing something he loves to do. It couldn't be further away from who he is right now.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that I did notice this time when I was watching it is, Otto Octavius, no. Dr. Connors says of Peter, he's brilliant but lazy. And I've written about Otto Octavius in this, he's paternal but arrogant.
Yeah.
Because there's this, and it's if we're talking about how he's everything that Peter Parker, you know, wants in life, he's also a warning to Peter about what happens if you misuse your gifts. We see in this film that Otto is supremely intelligent, and he could potentially revolutionize, you know, energy for the world and save the world. But he's so arrogant and he's so self-assured that he can't even foresee a world where he gets the math wrong. And we're talking about this before the tentacles, because when they're having food in that lab cum living space that Harry gives to the Octaviuses. Fun fact, that's a cinema, by the way. I read on IMDb.
Oh, really?
It is, yeah. So, you know, he's very arrogant in that scene, and there's even the, you know, like, the little bit of banter about how he can't understand Keats, but he was trying to explain advanced physics. And it is a warning to Peter about the misuse of gifts. And as I say, it's before the tentacles malfunction. My favourite scene in the entire film is when the expository journalist goes, but if the tentacles are as smart as you say they are, Dr. Octavius, couldn't they control you? And he goes, not because of this inhibitor chip in the back of my neck, where I've put precariously close to the edge. It's, you know, I really, really like Otto Octavius. I think he does something. He's a father figure to Peter again, but more than that, he's a very human enemy, because he's not wearing a mask. And like you say, it's why there's less banter. It's why the fights are less frivolous, because Peter knows this man. And he knows this man's gone through tragedy, because the death of Rosie, it's corny, but one of the most horrific deaths in cinema.
Yeah, because as much as the camera cuts away, you can imagine what that death was like in your head. Like, the glass is coming towards her eye, but it's not just the fact that it's not the glass in the eye that killed her, it's the thousands of other shards of glass that have clearly impaled her body and caused catastrophic damage to her body.
She was impaled by about 17 guillotines at once.
Yeah.
I think that the birth of Otto, the birth of Doc Ock informs Peter's relationship with the supervillain Dr. Octopus through the entire film, because he did know him when he was a man. When he finds out that Norman's the Green Goblin, he's shocked, you know, and there's that brief second where Norman tries to take advantage of it. Godspeed, Spider-Man. Mm-hmm.
Could not resist a Green Goblin impression in another episode.
No, I've been trying to get one in all episode. But speaking of the birth of Dr. Octopus, I want to talk about the surgery scene.
Yes, please.
Which to me is a highlight.
So I know we're going to go on to our favourite moments. It's not my personal favourite moment. However, it is probably the most visually well aging in terms of its placement in a superhero blockbuster, and this scene did go around on Twitter semi recently, just admiring the fact that such a set piece could be involved in what is considered a family blockbuster. But that is when, one, the practical effects of the mechanical tentacles really come into play, which is something that's also very impressive about The Birth of Doc Ock and even the initial presentation, because that's all practical. The robotic arms were built practically on set. They were only used in visual effects shots when he's climbing buildings and stuff like that. So the surgery scene features a huge amount of practical effects. The nails scraping on the floor as the surgeon is pulled away is horrible and was used using dried wax. It was made to happen using dried wax on the floor. And the fact that there is a chainsaw in it, which calls back to, obviously, Sam Raimi's Evil Dead.
Well, we even get Deadite camera when we see through the tentacles' eyes as they're going in. I absolutely love everything about the tentacles. I love the sound design. It was made using piano wire and the sound of a motorcycle engine revving up. They sound evil and demonic.
And alive. That's the key thing. I believe them to be sentient beings. I don't believe them just to be like artificial intelligence and general weaponry. They are evil, evil things.
Like you say, I think a big part of that comes down to the fact that they are there. Like, obviously, there were four puppeteers following Alfred Molina around, making the tentacles work. But they just... They're so kinetic, and they let Otto move in such an interesting way. He has, because essentially he's, as I mentioned before, you know, a rotund man with a pretty decent brain, but the tentacles are what make him dangerous and allow him to compete with Peter. And something that I think this film gets right, that the third film really should have done even better, was the tentacles allow Otto to compete with Spider-Man in three dimensions, like in a way we've not seen Spider-Man fight probably since. Maybe the closest we've seen is the plane scene in Homecoming. Mm-hmm. But the idea, moving up buildings and moving side to side, and they're on walls and they're flying through the air. I absolutely love everything about them. I think that they're, like you say, they feel evil and sinister, and the way they talk to him, like, you could just have it. It could be so cheesy, but the way they snake in and sort of like. The jaw almost goes on them as they're talking to him. But it works because Molina sells... First of all, he's always in two minds about everything. But he just sells it so well. I never feel that, like, oh, this is too camp or this is too silly. It just works so well. And it all comes down to the tentacles being there and Alfred Molina being such a talented actor.
Yeah, it falls into a very sweet spot for me of stripping back an outlandish comic prospect to some level of realism without taking away the fun. Like, you could still, it still feels like a comic book illustration or imagination come to mind, come to reality when you see Dr. Octopus fighting Spider-Man. However, like we keep saying, it's very, very believable. Fun enough, with the tentacles, the knife that comes out the tentacles,
The
death spear isn't in comic lore, if I'm correct in saying that. I know I'm not an expert, but I don't think that's something that's traditionally in the comics.
You are very correct. They are just scientific apparatus
Sam Raimi came up with that idea, which is, I mean, speaks to his roots more in horror, because that's like a really brutal piece of weaponry. I mean, that would do horrible, horrible things to Spider-Man if he flew straight into it. So, yeah.
I did like, I made a note during that scene where I was like, what does that do?
Like, it serves no purpose.
When he's injecting the tritium, of which there is only 20 pounds in the entire world, we are told, and Harry Osborn has it all. What does the spike that can apparently kill Spider-Man do?
Slice some really good bread. There we go. You asked. I answered. That's what I'm here for, Tom. Provide the real answers to the big questions.
Before we get too far away from it, what's something that I too scoured the IMDb trivia. And I found a gem from the novelization.
Okay.
It's not my favourite piece of trivia.
Okay, I've got a favourite piece of trivia, and I'll be interested to know if we land on the same one. I actually think we might, you know, out of the absolute treasure trove of trivia, I think we are going to pull out the exact same one out of the bag, but please go ahead.
IMDb trivia is so shit. I love that. No, my favourite piece of trivia is, in the novelisation, the exposition journalist, who I did an impression of before, is explicitly said to be Dr. Pym.
What?
Yes, and wait for it, and during when the experiment starts to go wrong, when the reactor starts to blow up, Dr. Pym disappears. Suspiciously fast. Then... after Otto's been knocked out, Dr. Pym reappears extremely quickly as well in what was a clear reference to Ant-Man.
That is a very good piece of trivia. That is also hilarious. Like, there's no point.
it adds nothing. It's such... I really want them to bring back novelizations of films where you get those really weird tidbits that it's like, this would be really cool if we could do this, but we can't, so we're just going to stick it in the novel.
Well, it's a bit... Well, even in the real movie, it's a bit like when they're trying to come up with names for Dr. Octopus and the sub-editor... says, oh, Doctor Strange. Oh, no, J. Jonah Jameson says, Doctor Strange. Oh, no, it's taken. It's like, yeah. Thank you for that nod to a comic character you're never going to use in this movie.
It isn't, it's even more annoying because it isn't even the only reference to Doctor Strange in the film. The pizza place that he works at is on Bleecker Street, about 10 roads up, 10 houses up from the Sanctum Sanctorum, is it? So, clearly, Sam Raimi could see into the future and knew that one day Scott Derrickson was going to be fired for saying he was going to make a horror film, and that he could then take over and make Doctor Strange 2.
I mean, it is serendipitous in that regard, when you look at how all the movies tie together.
It is, yeah. Mm. Do you think we'll get Spider-Man in Multiverse of Madness? I don't.
Really?
No.
I think he has to make an appearance just for... Raimi's sake. I'm sure he would love to like play with Holland Spidey even for 5 minutes.
See, I think if anything, we'll get a Maguire cameo that's hinted at what could be, but it's not.
Yeah.
I think you'll get that. I think that's it.
Whispers of pizza time from the Multiverse of Madness.
Something that I did want to ask again was, I do have IMDb trivia about this as well. Why is Otto Octavius robbing the bank? Like, I love that. I do really like that fight scene, but why is he robbing the bank?
Is it to, I would assume, to secure the financial monies to actually build a port rig?
And what's he doing? Is he then going on his to Amazon?
This is what's happening, Tom. He's walking into B&Q. Right, this is what he's doing. He's walking into B&Q with his sack of gold. And he's going, you listen here. I want your entire stock of 4x4s, all the metal you have, and I'm going to pay in exclusively gold coins.
Do you have any trivia? You don't? Okay. Fun fact, you know when Joel McHale picks up one of the gold coins and Aunt May clobbers him, making him drop them? This is the first time I've ever realised Americans don't use gold coins as their currency. No. But again, the novelisation to the rescue... It was treasure from a sunken pirate ship that Otto Octavius knew was in the bank vault, and that's why he attacked that bank.
This novelization is genuinely criminal. I need to read this. Why would you not just say it's just the Federal Reserve's gold or something like that?
Yeah.
That is what I think when I watch it. And you know what? I'm still going to think that when I watch it, because I refuse to believe that is treasure that Dr. Otto knew where to go for.
If they were silver dollars, then I'd be like, yeah, okay, Cameron's point stands. But they are clearly gold. The doubloons from a pirate ship that Otto Octavius knew about because the tentacles told him about it. So, of course, when Otto goes to rob the bank, we then get the first Spider-Man versus Otto Octavius fight scene, which is a taster, an appetizer for the main event.
Yeah.
We're just going to talk about it. The train scene.
The best superhero fight sequence of all time.
What about portals?
Oh, it's too big. Like, I think it's almost I actually don't mean that as a criticism. It's in its entire own category. Portals is too big to rival against anything else because literally no other superhero sequence will ever come close to that. Okay, so maybe I should be more accurate. The best superhero fight sequence of all time, excluding portals.
Yes, I would agree with you. I forget how good it is until I watch it. Because it's a very CGI-heavy sequence. But at the same time, I don't think the CGI has aged badly. You mentioned the scene when Spider-Man spins between the truck earlier. We get a similar sequence when Otto throws him and he spins between the bridge, avoiding people. I just think it demonstrates Peter's powers so succinctly in a way other films have struggled to. He is so agile. No other hero can move quite like him because he doesn't fly. He's not like Captain America who just runs everywhere. He can swing and he sticks to things. He moves in such a strange, almost Lovecraftian way. I absolutely love that entire sequence. And I think that any other villain, and it's a real shame, and I don't want to bash 3 just yet, but Venom should have had a similar action sequence because Venom can move like Peter. They have very, very similar power sets. It's tentacles and swinging and sticking to things, and, you know, they're both super strong. Otto's tentacles give him a similar power set, but it's different enough that the two of them fighting is just so satisfying to watch. Even if IMDb trivia did raise the specter of, how does Otto survive being punched by Peter Parker if Peter Parker can dent metal? It's like, well, you didn't hit him that hard. There you go. I've solved that one for you.
The entire train sequence, from start to finish, and even from the falling from the building, which features a kind of recurring trademark, if you will, of Spider-Man and Otto Octavius falling through the air in slow motion, and the sound cuts away just as they are punching each other. I just really like that. I think it's cool. Then they fall onto the train. Yeah, like everything you're saying there, it's very kinetic. It's exciting to watch. It's not dressed up to be hokey. Yes, the visual effects are prevalent throughout the entire scene just to make it possible, but they haven't aged badly at all because they're used in the exact right spots they need to make it count. And then practical effects are used where it's also required, for example, mainly inside when the fight moves inside the train in rare occasions that it does. And then obviously the climax of it when he's stopping the train, and it's an absolute huge moment of heroism for Spider-Man, not just in the movie but in the trilogy.
It's interesting you mentioned that because I cannot think of another sequence in a Spider-Man film that's, because so often the films are drawing from the comics, you know, the suit in the trash can, Eddie Brock, the Venom symbiote dripping down onto Eddie Brock in the church. So often the imagery we see in the films is inspired and drawn straight from the comics. The train stopping sequence when he's spinning the webs has informed the comics and the character in such an interesting way. It was in the recent Spider-Man video game. There's a sequence where you have to stop the subway train. Mm-hmm. That's lifted wholesale, literally from the film. And even then, in Spider-Verse, when we get Peter B. Parker's little flashback to his life, we see a similar sequence of him stopping the train with the webs. It's iconic. I'd go that far.
It's completely iconic. I mean, like in Homecoming, like the pulling the two halves of the boat back together. Clearly, I think calls back to Spider-Man 2 and shooting the webs to keep train from going off the edge. As much as a slightly different scenario, it's definitely imagery wise pulling back to that, and it leads into a moment of, like you pointed out in the last episode, earned saccharine New York spirit from the people on the train that actually feels genuinely sweet and makes your heart go, because these everyday group of New York commuters have now seen the identity of Spider-Man. The guy says he's just a kid, and then the two kids come over and say, we won't tell nobody, which is, I think it's so much better in how it's written than in the first Spider-Man movie, which is such a clear attempt to make people go, woo, Whereas in this, it's sweeter, it's more innocent. And those two boys are Tobey Maguire's half-brothers.
Are they actually? I did not know that.
From the treasure of IMDb trivia once again.
Yeah, I completely agree. It, for me, of all the hell yeah, this is New York City moments, that is the one that doesn't stick out to me. Mm. It feels organic. That moment of where, you know, the guy says he's just a kid, to the "you drop the mask, Spider-Man, don't worry, we won't tell no one." It doesn't feel like a, hey, we're New York and we do things differently here. It just feels like a real human moment of people, of, you know, of genuine appreciation for a man who's just saved their lives, and the shock that this man is a boy. True, this boy looks about 44, but whatever.
Yeah, I thought that was, he's just a kid. I was like, this guy looks older than me now. So
I also really enjoy how Otto Octavius then walks onto the train, and they you know, like, you want to get him, you gotta go through us, and he just goes, all right,
yeah. It's just remarkable that no one was seriously injured. If that scene just takes Spider-Man away and everyone else is fine, he catapults them to the side of the train with catastrophic force.
What I do like about it then is Otto then stops to get some barbed wire, wraps him up in it, and we get, again, just a real charmingly awkward moment when Otto delivers Spider-Man to Harry Osborn. He gets the tritium and he just goes and he leaves, and Harry decides he's going to unmask Spider-Man. Does it? Oh no, it's Peter Parker. And so Tobey Maguire gets up and breaks the barbed wire that he's been wrapped in. And it's the cheapest bloody prop you've ever seen in your life.
Literally looks like something you would wrap. You would make a bag for tangerines out of. That is what he rips out of, essentially.
He does, and it's, I'm not sure whether it's supposed to be this triumphant moment when he goes, like, he flexes out of it. It just does not hold up for me. Yeah, and of course then leads into the final sequence when Otto gets his redemption. And I think it's interesting that...
Tragic redemption as well.
Yeah, like, I you know, it's... Otto is kind of... I don't want to say it, Frankenstein's monster, because it's a very cliched thing to say, but he basically is, you know, this, he didn't want to be this, he didn't want to become this creature. He was born in a lab accident, and he chooses, and again, we're going back to that theme of personal choice here. Otto thinks what he's doing, he's using his gifts for the, you know, for the good of mankind, like Peter is, but he's misguided and he doesn't know. And in the end, he makes that choice to sacrifice himself, you know, to save the city. I'm not quite sure if you dropped a miniature sun into the Hudson River, that would magically stop it. But you know what? It works well enough in the film. Yeah. And we get...
I don't know how that works, to be honest. I did think that when I was watching. I was like, why has the sun not went out immediately, if that's what, if the water is going to suppress it? What will, what is that sun still blaring down there throughout Spider-Man 3, and any fishes that swim into it are just turned to dust? And
well, it's how he goes, you can't stop it, it's self-sustaining now, and it's like, so it's just there, I guess. Constantly evaporating parts of the Hudson.
The Bermuda Triangle of the Hudson, boats mysteriously sink under the water. Yeah, but I do like the ending for Dr. Octopus, and the fact that it does tie back to using his gift for the good of mankind. At that point he is, because he knows, through whatever godforsaken means, he knows with his intelligence that that is the way to end the ordeal.
And I also enjoy that, I spoke last time about how I don't like comic book films killing their main characters. I think that they made the right decision with Otto. I don't think there's a way that character comes back from that, almost, like, because it would have been strange to have him in hypothetical Spider-Man 4, for example, as Otto Octavius, as a villain again. You'd be a little bit like, okay, what happened? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know if he could even survive coming back, to be honest, because it would, in the hypothetical world that happened, he would have to have the apparatus removed from his back, and it's already, to be frank, fucked. So his spine is probably goosed from that.
He had a horrific death because he falls into the Hudson along with the miniature sun. Yeah. So presumably he was boiled alive moments after Spider-Man swung away with Mary Jane.
I would hope he drowned before that got to that point.
Well, there's no way he was swimming back up.
No.
So I've mentioned Mary Jane there, and I think it's time to move on to the extended cast. We were very, very critical of the treatment of MJ in the last one.
Yes.
I'm going to start a little more positive and start with a character I think gets a lot more to do. Aunt May.
Aunt May is borderline iconic in this movie. She has very... The scenes she's given in this movie are the meat of Aunt May in the Sam Raimi trilogy.
I think, like we mentioned before, she gets in on the action. She fights during the... She clobbers Ock during the bank scene. She gets... And that's when she flips on Spider-Man. She stops mistrusting him then. She gets that beautiful moment when you said before, about take the $20. It's not much, goddammit. Like, a real... Like, Rosemary Harris is just... She's a great actor. And she proves it in this film. And, of course, the big scene is when she basically tells Peter, I know you're Spider-Man. Me and neighbor boy were talking. We don't see Spider-Man's picture in the paper enough anymore. And in that moment, she knows that Peter's Spider-Man, or at least that's how I interpret it.
Yeah, I would interpret that also. I don't think you just dole out such an inspiring, heroic speech to your everyday puny son that is clearly speaking to something he is keeping secret for a reason.
We believe there's a hero in all of us.
But yeah, I mean, like you said, Rosemary Harris is absolutely phenomenal in this movie, and that scene, giving the speech is as much as it is slightly on the nose, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It speaks to the core themes of Spider-Man's resurrection, I suppose, from the problems he endures in Spider-Man 2. And there's also the scene when Peter reveals that he was at the wrong place during the death of Uncle Ben, and Rosemary Harris doesn't really say anything at all in that scene, but just the look on her face, that entire... interaction is horrible. Like, it's really, really heartbreaking, very, very sad, and it's been the ticking time bomb since that happened. You've been waiting on that dinner table conversation, and then it happens.
I agree completely. I think because we jokingly said that J. Jonah Jameson was the best thing, the best of the supporting cast in the last film. I think it's clearly Aunt May in this one. I don't think anyone does. J. Jonah Jameson's in this one, and I love him, but he's just comic relief. Aunt May's doing some real heavy lifting, and she's part of the reason why Peter comes back. She hammers home that message of personal responsibility that, essentially she reinforces the with great power comes great responsibility speech that Uncle Ben gave. Mm-hmm. It is no wonder Peter Parker grew up to be a superhero when he had these two teaching him through when he was a kid. We'll move on to Harry.
God.
Who, last time, we both said we didn't like Harry. I have written this time, better in this film because he's more obviously a contemptible prick. Because we're not trying to pretend that Harry Osborn is anything but an absolute bellend.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I think James Franco is very good at being that in this movie.
I wonder how he manages.
But yeah, from the very first scene with him in Aunt May's at the dinner, even looks completely different. I mean, he is a high profile exec at that point, which basically means black jumpers and stick up hair.
But this is a point, right? That's not how companies work, right? Your dad being on the board of a company does not mean when he dies in a tragic glider accident that you then inherit his position in that company. You might inherit his shares, but I don't think anyone in Oscorp was like, hey, this high school kid, this guy with a high school education, let's give him a place on the board. He seems to know his onions. Like, I don't understand. I mean, I do understand because Raimi's drawing from Silver Age Spider-Man and the idea of nepotism runs throughout. But it is just, it's so silly. The idea that he would inherit Norman's position simply because Norman had died.
Yeah, you say that, but then Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, but Bruce Wayne, okay. Bruce Wayne, no one, at least if we go by the Dark Knight canon, no one expects Bruce Wayne to turn up and run Wayne Enterprises, do they? They're all like...
Oh, to be fair, no, he does buy the shares. He buys the shares, yeah, and that's the point of his managing control.
He sells his shares to rebuy his shares, yeah, or something like that. Something only Christopher Nolan knows. No, I think that because Harry is clearly being set up to be the villain, he is an antagonist in this one, I think he works a lot better, because I didn't think he was backbiting like he was in the first one. And as you said, that first scene is so uncomfortable. Like, you know, when he's like taking pictures of the bug, it's just, oh, I don't know.
You just want to tell him to like go away. It's like, oh, give it a break, mate.
But before then as well, he's saying to Peter, he's like, yeah, she's the girl of your dreams. You just need to go over there. And it's like, okay, do you hate me? Do you like me? What's going on here?
No, to be fair, as much as I don't really like Harry Osborn's character in the Sam Raimi trilogy, I think he is where he needs to be in Spider-Man 2 before it goes into the most outrageous James Franco performance ever in Spider-Man 3. So yeah, I feel warmer like you do on James Franco in this movie. However, I still don't particularly like Franco's performance as Harry. And I never really feel anything towards Harry as a character when I'm watching. He is just like a vehicle for another story thread in the movie that I don't particularly feel any passion for.
I think as well, we're coming out through the benefit of hindsight. We know that the Harry Osborn Green Goblin story essentially goes nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, it's a damp squib of a storyline. It gets us Norman Osborn in this film. That's the one thing I'll say about it. That we get Willem Dafoe in a scene-stealing performance when he turns up at the mansion as a ghost to tell Harry to avenge me.
To be fair, the hindsight argument is absolutely fair enough, because I do remember watching this movie and when Harry smashes the mirror and he finds Green Goblin's lair with all the weaponry and thinking, fuck, man. Like, like, what is going to happen? What is going to happen with this? So, yeah, I guess I'm being slightly harsh on it, but that is the benefit of hindsight, and I'm just going to hold to that because I don't think it's very good.
Look, you know, 2 years later, you find out that fuck all happened to him. He's dealt with in the first 15 minutes.
Yes.
We've avoided talking about it for long enough now. Mary Jane. I think I said in the last episode that she gets more to do in the second one. But she doesn't, does she? She is, again, just something Peter wants and he's working towards. I will say she has slightly more agency in that she's getting engaged. You know, she's certainly doing better in her career. But again, let's play the game. Can you tell me anything about Mary Jane other than her job and the man that she's dating?
No.
There you go. It says everything. I didn't realise, I've never really realised how badly treated Kirsten Dunst is in this film.
Don't get me wrong, I think if we're looking at it overall, I do think it's the best MJ Peter movie that we have. There is scenes throughout it which show the strain on their relationship, and there's the scene which I actually think is very good when he's at the payphone and he's desperately trying to explain why he was late and he's failing, and then it hangs up and then he just like confesses to silence, basically, that he's Spider-Man. That's what he deeply, deeply wants to tell her. And yeah, well, the movie, she does remain a goal. I do still think it's a more interesting dynamic than they had in the first movie.
Again, though, it's like, I agree, I think the phone sequence is great, but it tells us so much more about Peter than it tells us about MJ. Yeah. And again, the scene when I want to pick things up where we left off, you never got on. Again, it's like you're saying, it's more interesting because there's, you know, there's the hint of some drama there, but it's just, it's never quite realised. And maybe the problem is that I'm coming at it in a 2020 kind of way, and let's be honest, superhero films just weren't there then. I think that's part of it. Not that that's a good excuse.
Fun enough, one of my favourite moments in the movie, maybe even my favourite moment in the movie, is an MJ moment, and it's the very last shot of the movie, which follows the go get him tiger of them two finally getting together, which is it's a really cheesy moment, but it's great because even at that time when you're watching it, you're invested and it's like, yes, he's finally got the girl, and the whole cycle of Peter struggling with life is finally over because he's got MJ. But then that look on her face as he is flying away into the New York skyline is haunting, really, because that is a look on her face going, I am forever at the whims of this now, and I have subjected myself to it. And even Danny Elfman's music tunes out to a darker note as the camera is fading away on her face. And I think it's almost eerie that does connect into her criticisms of the movie, because the whole point of that being quite affecting is that she is forever, as I said, at the whims of Spider-Man, but it's just a shame that the rest of the movie treats her so.
Again, it's all about personal choice. That's the theme of this film. You choose your own life, and she chose to leave John Jameson, is it?
Mm.
Yeah, John, she chooses to leave John for Peter, and as you say, she's accepted that last scene to me is her, she's accepted that this is her life now, that she is, you know, in love with Spider-Man and dating Spider-Man, but that there will be a day when Spider-Man doesn't come back through that window.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I do think that that's quite an affecting moment, and I do like the go get him, Tiger, when they hear the siren and they have to break away from that kiss. It is very effective. Yeah, maybe I am. Maybe I'm quite harsh. It could be that I've just, you know, when I saw this when I was a kid, the Mary Jane stuff was never my favourite stuff, and I've just carried that into adulthood a little bit.
Yeah, I think on the flip side, I have said in the previous episode I romanticised the relationship quite a bit because I did find it very affecting and probably as a youngster watching it, my favourite superhero trying to get the girl is just like a thread that there's a reason that trope exists, as well as inherent sexism in Hollywood. It's there's a reason people find it relatable, and that's why I like it.
I just find MJ a little milquetoast for my taste. She's in the
great
comics,
word
at least,
great word.
Yeah, I know. She's vivacious and she's a party girl, and she's, the comics give her some depth for why she's like that, and it's very, very, you know, surface armchair psychology stuff of why she's such a party girl. But the one thing that I'd say about Mary Jane is that she's feisty and she fights for what she wants. And I don't know if the films ever really got that. Maybe the Go Get 'Em Tigers, the one glimpse of that we get.
Well, the Go Get 'Em Tiger is a proper woo. Like that's how it makes you want to do that when you watch it. But regretfully, she doesn't have many other moments like that in the trilogy.
I don't even really remember in Spider-Man 3, which will make watching.
Oh, I have some choice words to say about MJ in Spider-Man 3.
Let's move on to Raimi, because, you know, as we said in the last one, Raimi, I don't think we said this, that I consider Raimi an auteur. I think you know when you're watching a Raimi film, except for that Wizard of Oz film he made. I think that, go on, you look like you had a point.
No, I don't. I was about to correct you on the Oz film title, and then I forgot what it was called. So
Great and Powerful Oz? Anyway, it's not important. Yeah, I think Raimi is an auteur, and I wish he was still making films. I know we were talking about making Doctor Strange, but between Drag You to Hell and now, we've only got Oz the Great and Powerful, haven't we?
Yeah. He's produced things, hasn't he? Directed things. So I would agree. I think he is completely an auteur, and you know when you're watching a Sam Raimi movie, like Evil Dead, has cast an indelible shadow on horror. The Spider-Man movies have casted an indelible shadow on the superhero genre, or people don't consider it a genre, superhero movies in general, and he still manages to integrate his flourishes and his trademarks like the Deadite cam and general just horror, his love of horror, into his movies. And I look forward to him directing Doctor Strange, because that will hopefully tie back into more of his horror stuff.
Yeah, as we said during the Birth of Doc Ock scene, which is what it's called in the DVD menu, by the way, and that's something that stuck with me. I think that's the most Raimi the film gets. We, of course, get another beautiful Bruce Campbell cameo.
It's the best one, I think.
It is. There's the usher. I, I'd forgotten the moment when Peter walks through the door and he goes, "Shoelace."
And Peter, you might want to. Oh, right. Can I help you?
He's just such a twat. I mean, have we mentioned the grand plan for Bruce Campbell?
Yeah, it was not. It was going to be in the fourth movie as the villain, was it not?
He was going to be revealed to be Mysterio in the cold opening of the fourth film.
That would be awesome. I would love that.
I really, really like that. And the idea was that he was casing different joints to rob them. I really like that idea, especially because I would have loved to have seen Raimi's take on the Mysterio costume.
Yeah.
Because I think, knowing Raimi, he would have done his best to make Campbell look an absolute clown.
Also, Bruce Campbell's Quentin Blake is an absolutely astonishing bit of casting.
The best chin in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, considering how long we spoke about in the first episode about Spider-Man, I think because we like this film so much, it is almost more difficult to talk about.
Well, it's difficult to talk about while sounding somewhat professional without just saying, "Oh my God, I love it, I love it, I love it." But that is how I feel. That, as much as I'm trying to sound articulate and eloquent about it, the bottom line of how I feel about this movie is I love it to pieces, and it does things for me as a Spider-Man movie that other Spider-Man movies haven't.
Yeah, I think that's sort of my final thoughts on it as well, that it is, without a doubt now, and maybe I'll feel differently after we've rewatched Amazing Spider-Man, it is, without a doubt, the best Spider-Man film. It ticks every box. As I said at the beginning, it internalizes that idea of personal responsibility so well. Everything about it is firing on all cylinders. The villain is perfect in every single way. At the time, I can't think of another villain who would have compared to him. Had we had Batman Begins by the time of Spider-Man 2?
No, this came out 2004, and Batman Begins was 2005.
So I'm going to go on the record, and this is to get Alfred Molina on this podcast, that Dr. Octopus was, at the time, the best superhero villain we'd had. Or at least the most complex. And yeah, you can put it in your pipe, Nicholson fan.
I was literally about to say that.
I know what you're going to say. Jack Nicholson's Joker is a joke. Dr. Octopus.
There's the headline. The poster.
Always
quote.
A social editor. get your line in. Okay, well, we're going to start to wrap up then. So I'm going to ask you... In fact, no. Before I ask you about your favourite moment, I want to ask you, and we're going to make this a regular feature now, who can find the best bit of trivia about the film?
Okay.
So what is your favourite piece of IMDb trivia?
My favourite piece of trivia relates to the music.
Of course, I should have known.
Obviously, Danny Elfman's composition for Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2, some of the best. The main title from Spider-Man 2 is the best Spider-Man theme, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. However,
it's the theme that introduces this podcast.
It is. However, Danny Elfman and Sam Raimi had a very, very severe fallout, and they did not work together until the Oz movie, after this movie, because Danny Elfman is not the composer on Spider-Man 3. The reason they had such fallout is because of studio interference and wanting to use the temp track, so the score that was already laid down for the movie before Danny Elfman came in to do his own score. And they had specific cues they wanted to use for the movie. One of the cues, which is the birth of Doc Ock... is that the surgery scene that's referred to the birth of Doc Ock? Okay, so before that, the palm of the sun... and the power of the sun in the palm of my hand. The music that plays there is not Danny Elfman's. Licensed cue from Christopher Young's score from Hellraiser 2.
Oh my God! You're joking.
No, and they tried... So basically they tried to encourage Danny Elfman to do a cue in the style of that and echo it, and Danny Elfman clearly felt uncomfortable trying to basically just ripping off the work of another artist. So that is why multiple composers are listed under Spider-Man 2, because they just licensed the cue from Hellraiser 2 from Christopher Young. So the music that plays when that stuff is happening is straight Hellraiser 2 music.
That is my favourite piece. See, we have very different taste in trivia, because that piece of trivia is incredible. It's also very niche, because no one listening to this knows our love for the Hellraiser films.
That's true.
Or the fact we're in a group chat called Hellbazer. but that is that. That's pretty good. Yeah. It's pretty good. I pulled from the novel again.
This fucking novel. Is it easily bought, or is it like a rarefied piece?
No, it is not easily bought, but you can find it on Tumblr. I'll tell you that. Okay, so I toyed with a few things. That this was initially going to be called The Amazing Spider-Man. That was the first title he had.
Yes.
that this is the only live-action Spider-Man to have ever won an Oscar.
Yes. Also, it is. Yeah, of course.
Sorry. I then found one of those naff pieces of trivia that only exist in on the very end of the IMDb list. Both this and The Incredibles, 2004, are 2004 superhero movies featuring the lead characters stopping a moving train.
Oh, I love IMDb, but fucking hell, man.
But my favourite piece of trivia in this is, and I thought I made a note of it, but I can't actually seem to find it now, which is really annoying. But so I'm going to have to do it from memory, which is going to make it even better. So in the novelization, after Otto's got the tentacles stuck on his back, a hitman called Jack gets a giant robot and attacks Otto Octavius in an attempt to stop his experiments with tritium.
What?
And that was in the initial script.
What? I am pursuing this novelization with every force I have in my weapon set to find this book on eBay.
So yeah, let's get off the IMDb trivia, which is incredible, and get to the big questions. What's your favourite moment of the film? I think you've already covered it.
I mean, I think probably the train scene. Train scene's got got to be my favourite. I do like the MJ, the ending with MJ. That's the thing that really does stay with me after watching the movie. But if you were to give me my gut response, it's always the train scene.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think, we've been over it and over it. If it's the greatest action sequence in a film, it has to be the greatest moment in the film, doesn't it, to be honest?
Yeah, of course.
And I'll do my least favourite moment, and again, we've touched on it. The raindrops keep falling on my head montage as Peter witnesses horrific crimes in New York City. I don't care that Peter has lost his powers at this point, or at least he's buried his powers. If I saw a mugging, I'd at least go, there's a mugging there, someone do something. I wouldn't just stand there and go like, oh, if only I could do something. You can. You can literally...
just watches and shoves a hot dog down his throat. It's like, yeah. Oh, well.
And of course, then we get that awkward freeze frame. Why is it in the film?
Because it's magnificent. Probably the most outrageous use of freeze frame. Next to Harry Potter and Prisoner of Azkaban's ending on a freeze frame of Harry soaring through the air.
Do we get any other montage? No, sorry, not montages. I mean, like, we get the Hold On by Jet that plays when Peter's getting ready for the theatre show. That's really stood out to me this time as well. That I don't remember not in Spider-Man 1 and not in Spider-Man 3, do we get such overt musical cues, do we?
No, not really.
I actually really like that sequence, yeah. the Hold On sequence with when he's got the suit on one side and the Spider-Man suit on the other side.
Yeah.
But what's your least favorite moment in the film?
Honestly, I think my least favorite moment is probably the party with the astronaut and the engagement and the taking photographs of my son, the astronaut. Something about it. I mean, it features a lot of Harry. Probably is my main issue with it. And the all right, partner, all right, brother, yeah. slapping in the face. It's just so awkward, man. Like, and it features some really like melodramatic stuff between him and MJ. And it just kind of sticks out. I don't think it should be taken out of the movie. I just get almost nothing from it whatsoever. I'm waiting for it to end anytime it comes on.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I wrote three moments: the freeze frame, engagement scene, Peter's birthday. Not because they're bad, but because of how awkward they are.
Yeah,
are what my notes say. And again, maybe it's just Harry Osborn. That, like you're saying, he just anytime he's in a scene, I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, no, I would definitely say a dinner scene, but I mean that's quite good that is my opinion. Like, there's no scene that really outright angers me throughout Spider-Man 2, like the inexplicable donut of the first movie.
The inexplicable donut. You hate that guy in his jam donut.
It's literally the most stupid bit of cinematography. Like, surely, and no one filming that thought, this is stupid, no one eats a donut like this. Oh, I'm not going to get angry about it again.
No, save your anger, because next week we're going to be talking about Spider-Man 3.
God, help us all.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie, I really enjoyed rewatching Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2. It's going to... I've got the Blu-rays, I've got the box set that comes with the Sony one, the complete Sony collection, so it's Spider-Man 1, 2, 3, Amazing Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man 2. I have never opened Spider-Man 3, Amazing Spider-Man or Amazing Spider-Man 2. This will be the first time the cellophane's been cracked on them.
Oh, it's such a steep drop in quality for a while now.
It is. I'm genuinely trying to think of a way to inject some positivity into things. Like, maybe we'll do a random 30-minute episode on on the cartoon or something.
Yeah.
Just to break up the vitriol that's going to spill from us in the next three episodes.
You know, Spider-Man 3 does have things to love in it. That's what I'll say to finish off. I think there's things to love in Spider-Man 3, and I do actually look forward to watching it again, so I can get from that what I did when I watched it as a child.
Right, well, it's time for my surprise question. Which I'm, again, just deciding on the fly to make a feature. Did you know that hope dangles on a string, like slow-spinning redemption, winding in, winding out, the shine of which has caught my eye, and roped me in so, mesmerizing so, hypnotizing so. I am captivated, I am vindicated. And that is Dashboard Confessional to Players Out.
Like that, another episode of Swinging Through Spider-Man has come to an end. If you enjoyed listening to Tom and I chat about your friendly neighbourhood Spider-Man, please like and subscribe and follow us on Twitter too. Remember, with great power comes great responsibility.